This show is a Hopful Media podcast production. Wait, wait, wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernales books.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America's Secret Wars, the podcast about forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately covered up times the United States has used military force to fight or occupy foreign nations. I'm your host, Trevor Cully, and with me today I have, what do I even call you guys now? The co-hosts of Tsar Power, half of Sword Sorcery and Socialism, and like 75% of the history of Socrates Fellow Georgia. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
100% of it now. Hi, I'm Roberto. I am the host, co-host of Tsar Power, Quest for Power, and also the one and only person working on the history of Socrates Fellow Georgia, except for when Aurora's editing it.
And I'm Aurora. I am the co-host of Tsar Power and of Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism. My two podcasts, and the editor of a bunch of other ones that I won't even get into because it's too many.
Yeah. Aurora, for a history podcasting inside joke, you are becoming your own version of Nate Bethay.
But thanks for having us on.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you. For listeners, we'll be able to tell if you've been listening for a while that there has been a shakeup on Tsar Power and Aurora performed a coup.
That's right. Proletarian revolution, actually.
Not in this episode. Because...
Does the monarchy win?
there aren't any other contenders in this episode. Last time I had Roberto on to talk Tsar Power was for our episodes on the Trieste crisis in the first years after World War II. This episode is weirdly a prequel to that I did not know happened when I wrote that first episode. And normally this is where I ask people
about their relationship to history class in school, but you've answered that already, both of you. But I am curious to know how your schools talked about World War One.
What? What war?
Sorry, what? What war?
World War One.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, sorry, again, what? What war?
Yeah.
I don't...
Okay, I'm glad we're all on the same page.
That's a war? I'm going to be entirely honest with you. I took an AP U.S. history class my junior year of high school, and I think we talked about World War One for maybe, I don't know, two class periods total, which would be like, you know, 2 hours. And it's like, hey, all the kings, the guy got shot, and then all the countries went to war, and America came in later to save the day.
I mean, that's basically how it was. I took AP European History my senior year, and it was very much the, oh yeah, that, you know, this happened. They went to war. It was a quagmire. A giggity giggity. And then we went forward and jumped to World War II, because we had to do AP test stuff.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's my experience with it in school, too, is about, I don't know, 90 minutes of an AP history class before it was time to move on so we could cover the rest of the test.
Hey, I mean, that's more time than I got with Korea and Vietnam combined, so, you know.
I didn't cover those in school.
I love America.
Everything I know about U.S. history after 1945 had to be learned independently. But yeah, so for anybody who somehow doesn't know, before World War II, there was a World War I, and Aurora's summary was actually mostly fine. The inbred monarchies of Europe got mad at each other for about 40 years at the end of the 19th century, kept stockpiling weapons, murdered an archduke, and then butchered a generation of men in trenches for years. We're not exactly talking about World War I this time. That is actually on the list of America's secret wars because of everything we just said. But it's a big enough topic that I feel like I need to buy whoever guests on those episodes a drink first. Today is a weird sort of prequel to the third and fourth episodes of the show that I did with Roberto before, and to reuse something that's becoming an evergreen joke on this show, if I had a nickel for every time the U.S. helped occupy a disputed city between Italy and Yugoslavia after a world war, I'd have two nickels. Which isn't much, but it's weird that it happened twice.
What the fuck? Is this what I'm back for?
Yes.
That is exactly what you're back for. So have either of you, and I'm assuming the answer is no.
Oh, dear Lord.
Have either of you ever heard of a little town called Trogir, Croatia?
Trogir? I know of it, but I don't know the history. No. I play too many map games.
No, I know. I don't know Trogir.
Why would you? You're in good company, because from the sources that I had for this episode, the United States Navy forgot about this incident almost as soon as it happened.
Love it.
For context, we're talking about events that start in like 1919, and by 1927 it's the often forgotten incident in Trogir. Like, in less than a decade, that's how it's being referred to in like Navy documents.
Love to have a forgettable incident.
The what are we talking about?
This is an event known as the Facts of Trogir, or the Fatti Trau, yeah, in Italian. And speaking of that, there are a few cities involved today with multiple names in history, primarily an Italian one and a Slavic one. Generally speaking, I try to use the name from the language that's actually spoken by the people living there, or some anglicized equivalent. So I will mostly be using the Croatian names today, partly to spite the Italians.
Understandable.
That said, most of the sources you'll find in English use the Italian names because those were the ones in frequent use at the time. And the exception to this rule today is that Rijeka will still go by its Italian name, Fiume.
Fiume.
Everybody. For reasons.
Oh. I know about Fiume.
I actually don't know about Fiume.
So I might actually know a little bit of what's going on because I know about Fiume in pre-war Italy.
I thought that might clue you in onto where this story is going.
Okay, I do know where this story is going.
I do not. This would be great.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
I'm not going to spoil it for you, Roberto.
To give you a small amount of foreshadowing, I was looking at this, doing the research, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I have enough here to get a whole episode. And then I got to that part, and I was like, oh, this is going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And usually I'm able to find some book or article that made up the backbone of my research. Today, we've got a lot less to work with, and most of my sources are either, like, U.S. Navy reports or newspaper articles from the time. I wouldn't even have known this happened if it weren't for a single line in the congressional report that I get a lot of my topics from that just said troops landed at Trogir, Croatia. And I was like, well, what's the story there?
Yes, tell me, what did they do there?
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
So, like I said, Trogir is one of those places that are especially common in the Mediterranean, where the name has been more or less the same for thousands of years. An ancient Greek colony called Tregurion was settled on this little island, just barely its own landmass between the coast of modern Croatia and a larger island sometime around 300 BC.
Mm-hmm.
It's been there basically ever since, updating the name based on whichever language was in charge at the time.
Oh, this reminds me of that one Doctor Who episode. All hail, insert invader here. And then they just change their names alongside to that language.
It's a lot like that, actually. Trogir was an important trading center from the very beginning, and the surrounding region was called Illyria, and then Dalmatia by the Romans.
Oh, I know this.
And that was the name that stuck on the southern coast of Croatia into the modern period. This province is still called Dalmatia today.
Cool. I know this part.
In the 9th century, Slavic Croats arrived, and over the next few centuries started to become the dominant ethnic group. Trogir passed between a bunch of different medieval kingdoms. At one point, it was an independent city-state. Then it was conquered by Venice. Keep that one in mind. Then it was Hungary. It was burned down by Egyptian raiders. And it even became the Hungarian capital for a few years during the Mongol invasion.
What?
when the Hungarians had to run
Wait,
from the rest of
that's
country.
That's how I know Trogir.
The horses can't cross water, so they went to the nearest island.
That's why. I've been reading some Mongolian history for reasons.
For, yeah, very obscure reasons if you know anything about the history of Russia. In 1420, Trogir came under Venetian rule once again, and that stuck around until Venice collapsed as an imperialist power in 1797, at which point Trogir was annexed by the Austrian Habsburg Empire.
It is really funny to think that, like, Venice as, like, an independent sort of, like, colonial sort of, or imperial polity, like, was still around after the American Revolution.
Yeah, especially because, like, I think
for a while.
Like, I always thought they, like, this.
Like, it's one of those things where you, like, consciously you know they existed at the same time, but when you actually, like, put it together. Like, the fact that was it that, like, Abraham Lincoln could send a telegraph to a samurai. It's like that sort of thing where you're like, I didn't realize that these things were, like, co-located in time. That, like, the Venetian Empire was still a polity after the American Revolution. Because, you know, Venice, you're thinking, like, it's
part
the
of me
Renaissance
always thinks
still.
It's like they just disappeared after, like, the 1500s and just, like, faded into obscurity.
Nope, they still ruled most of the Adriatic Sea up to about the time there was a United States. At some point, someone like Thomas Jefferson had to consider trade relations with the Doge.
fucking Thomas Jefferson. Hate his guts.
I want to be the American ambassador to the...
What a good boy.
Yeah, to the Doge.
What a good boy.
Elon Musk, ambassador to Venice.
Oh, God. No.
Horrible. Horribleness.
So this long period... Yeah, oh, God. The long period of Venetian rule brought a lot of Italians to the city, which they called Trau. When Napoleon briefly conquered Habsburg territories, Trogir and the surrounding area was actually made part of his vassal kingdom of Italy because it was so heavily Italianized at the time, but it reverted to Austrian control after Napoleon's defeat. Listeners and or Roberto may notice that this backstory is almost identical to the story of Trieste, and that's because it's basically all of the exact same things happening. Except Trieste was much, much closer to the Italian land border. There were tons of these cities. Basically, the entire coast of the Adriatic Sea is just cities like this that are squashed between Italian hegemony and Austrian hegemony for most of the 19th century.
Sounds like
honestly,
an awful
place
to
having to deal with all those Austrians.
Yeah. Well,
Austrians are. Oh, you get to pick between Austrians.
Italians
or Italians.
Have better food.
Terrible.
Some people did try to change things. Despite revolutionaries' best efforts, the Italians weren't able to conquer much Austrian territory during the unification of Italy. But God damn it, did they want to.
This just reminds me of World War One, where, like, the Italians were just, like, stuck in a quagmire trying to invade into, like, the mountain passes and just not having a great time going through against the Central Powers.
That is basically the history of Italy from the moment they come into existence until 1944.
Got it.
Yes. Also, anyone familiar with history will know that, like, when you get to the next big war, to World War II, one of Mussolini's big things obviously was, like, restoring the glory of Rome or whatever, because that's what fascists love. And one of his main things was, I think is what you're getting into, which was restoring Italian control over historically Italian land, a.k.a. like the Adriatic coast on the opposite side from Italy, like Dalmatia and such. He believed it was rightfully Italian land.
Yeah, and this movement that you're describing was called irredentism. They wanted Italy to annex Dalmatia, and that was a frequent source of revolt from Dalmatian Italians in the back half of the 19th century.
Of course.
And just doesn't go away. The irredentists basically looked at the map of the Venetian Empire at its... not at its territorial max. None of them thought they were going to go conquer Constantinople. But...
you can try.
At its, like, stable, normal territory, they wanted to include all of Venice's territory in Italy.
Don't blame them on that one.
Despite all of the irredentist goals, Italy actually formed the Triple Alliance with the Austrians and Germans in 1882 because all three of them were really worried about a war with France. And both Italy and the Austrians were having on and off wars with the Ottoman Empire. I only bring this up because since we're about to talk about Italy in World War I, I want to dispel a popular myth. Yes, technically Italy was allied with Germany and Austria in 1914 when the Great War began, but they didn't switch sides. They stayed officially neutral until they joined the Entente, which is the Allies. Yes, it would be funny if they switched sides twice, but that didn't actually happen.
Oh, lame.
We don't have to lie about that, but we don't have to lie about is how bad at fighting wars the modern state of Italy has been.
And that is the next thing I have to say, is that there is another meme about Italy in the World Wars, and that's the fact that their military sucked ass.
That one's true.
If only they could get the real military strength of Rome, they'd be fine. They should probably get back into cuirasses and get some spears and just go for it.
See, Italians, get a gladius.
You guys were good with those.
It's the only way you'll defeat Austria. So, the other allies knew that Italian irredentists wanted to conquer a bunch of Austro-Hungarian territory, including Trentino and South Tyrol to the north, the Venezia Giulia from our Trieste episode to the northeast, and Dalmatia across the Adriatic. Italy was given the green light to annex that territory if they sided with the Entente. Opening a southern front pulled resources from the Central Powers away from Russia and France. It just turns out that the Italian Italian army in 1915 wasn't actually good at conquering things, and they got stuck fighting fortified mountains for the next 3 years.
Oh, that's what I hinted at.
Russia was very hesitant to allow this because their allies in Serbia really did not want the Italians to get most of this territory. Remember, the great European meat grinder of 1914 got started when Serbian nationalists assassinated the Austrian Archduke. Russia was backing the Serbs, who wanted to form a pan-Slavic state in the Balkans. Most of Dalmatia was predominantly Croat. The Venezia Giulia was an even split between Italian and Slovene. And unrelated to all of this, South Tyrol is still more German than Italian today.
Sure is.
Is Tyrol in Italy?
Yes.
Huh. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And full of Germans. It's full of weird German yeah. speakers.
It's like being in Miami.
I don't know how Italy chose which areas were historically theirs, but it doesn't make a lot of sense.
I mean, it's like being in Miami in the U.S. You know, it's full of Spanish speakers in a predominantly English-speaking country.
I mean, Miami's just been annexed by pre-Castro Cuba.
I mean, yeah, that's where I'm from.
Yeah.
But in this case, the war went on, Italy joined on the side of the Allies, and all of Europe murdered each other in new and exciting ways.
Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao.
No, that comes at the end of this
okay,
episode.
Okay.
Yes.
Then 1917 happened. The United States, despite remaining officially neutral for the first 3 years, had clearly been playing favorites with the Allies and finally decided to join in person. Russia had itself a communist revolution or three, and mostly dropped out of the World War to do a civil war instead.
Yeah.
Which killed, like, as
more.
Many
they
people.
Did better. They killed more people in the Civil War than they killed in World War I.
They were more motivated
so many dead
for that
Russians.
One.
Yeah. Get ready for an Aurora. That's all we're going to be talking about for a while.
That's just Russian history. It's just, oh, so many dead Russians.
Yeah, when it's not murder, it's freezing to death. It's fine. Yeah. We don't have time to explain all of the peace talks at the end of the Great War, but the important thing is that U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, with varying levels of support from other allies, went hard on nationalism. Except, not the kind of nationalism you might think of with Woodrow Wilson.
Fucking Wilson.
He was, in fact, maybe now second most racist person to ever be president without actually owning a slave. But in this case, nationalism kind of has two definitions. National supremacy and national self-determination. I think we should have different words for these because they mean very different things. But basically, one is nationalism of the dominant culture wanting to remain dominant and become more secure in its dominance, or nationalism of a group of people who do not have a nation state for themselves and typically are in some ways a lower class than the dominant group. The U.S. wanted everybody to get their own nation state at this time, or at least every person with similar facial features to Woodrow Wilson and lighter skin than a Werther's Caramel Candy.
Oh, so I don't get a country. Got it.
he wanted to do what we would call now Balkanize, like basically everywhere that was white.
Yeah, he wanted to balkanize the gigantic European empires. Because at the time, the common way of looking at the situation was that having these gigantic, power-hungry super-states all over Europe, which is not a big enough place for them all to continue expanding forever, is what caused all these wars. It turns out what caused all these wars is a variety of different things, depending on the war you're looking at.
Greed. Incest.
And that breaking this up just created more people to murder each other.
It's just all the incest that causes war.
Yes, obviously. That and the lead.
Yeah.
Yeah. That and all the lead they were consuming.
But nobody knew any of this was going to lead to significantly greater horrors within the next, 5 to 10 years. So they focused on nation building in the peace talks after World War I. The Yugoslavs, Yugo literally meaning south, to contrast with the other Slavs traditionally under Russian rule, became the poster child for Wilson's view of a future run by nation states. That put the United States' general goals for a post-war settlement directly at odds with Italy, who didn't feel like Italians being made a minority in the Adriatic would make that region any less Italian. Also, officially, the new southern Slavic state that was founded when Austria-Hungary collapsed was called the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes for over a decade, but even while it was officially called that, everyone just wrote Yugoslavia, and that's way easier to
based.
Say.
Than giving off the full list of titles.
I mean, you could call it, the KSCS or something, but, it's Yugoslavia. It becomes Yugoslavia by the end of the decade. It's fine.
All hail Tito.
I guess what I was saying the whole last episode.
That's the last episode, yeah.
No Tito just yet. He comes up later.
It's okay. Both of these episodes feature at least one genocide.
I mean, we are talking about the area known as Yugoslavia.
I kind of assume it is going to contain genocide if it's Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
Who's it this time? The Albanians?
You might be surprised. Just as the Great War was wrapping up, when everyone knew the armistice would be signed at 11:11 on November 11th, 1918, but it hadn't happened yet, the Italian government signed a separate armistice with Austria at the Villa Giusti that required the Austrians to hand over the land promised to Italy in the Treaty of London 3 years earlier. This separate armistice also made a provision for Allied troops to occupy formerly Austrian territory. Basically, Italy made sure they had a backup plan if the Allies tried to screw them over, and then they added a provision that would force the very same people that might be trying to screw Italy into helping them with their annexation. To solidify the terms of this agreement, Italy sent naval units into a series of major ports all over the Adriatic to kick out Austro-Hungarian soldiers and Yugoslav partisans alike within the days leading up to November 11th. They knew the war was over, and they did a full-scale amphibious invasion.
Love that.
By the terms of the agreement, Austria had to hand over most of its navy to Italian control. Austria tried to get one over on Italy by gifting their fleet to the newly formed Yugoslavia before the treaty came into effect, but the Allies wouldn't allow it. Although, they also weren't really keen on the Austro-Italian armistice agreement either. What ended up happening here is they split up the fleet in a bunch of different ways, and part of it did become the new Yugoslavian navy.
Go, go, Yugoslavia!
But all of this backhanded, under-the-table dealing between Austria and Italy pissed off the Americans and the British, who, like I said, wanted a stable Yugoslav kingdom, both as a buffer against the new Soviet Union and as an example of nationalist anti-imperialism that somehow the British Empire claimed to be fighting for.
Wait a second. How's the imperialist hegemon fighting for anti-imperialism? That makes no sense to me.
It's because you're not thinking big enough.
Only English-speaking people can do empire, Roberto. Everybody knows this.
Fine.
It's not, if it's not, if it's not the UK or America, it's not imperialism, actually. If it doesn't come from the imperial core, it's just sparkling nation building.
Oh, so they just drew fine lines on a map and were like, this is your new territory.
No, they worked very closely with the Yugoslav government in this case. Like, they really needed this new country to work to prove that they had been right and justify doing World War One.
Okay, so I see no issues. I see no precedents that this causes in the future.
Nope. France wanted a strong southern neighbor in Italy to assist them in future conflicts with Germany. It sounds so dumb when you know where it goes. But everyone agreed that while the old Habsburg Empire was still collapsing, the most volatile regions would need to be occupied by the victorious Allies. And that's a standard part of doing a big war. Dalmatia was assigned to the American occupation forces, based in the city of Split on the mainland, directly across a narrow strait from Trogir. The American occupation zone was bordered to the north by the Italian occupation, and further south, the Albanian coast was occupied by France. The northern coast of the Adriatic, centered on the city of Fiume, was occupied by Britain. Italy was included as one of the big four negotiating powers at the Paris Peace Conference, but the so-called Adriatic Question drove a wedge between them and the other allies. And when something is called the Place or People Question, with a capital Q, it has literally never ended well.
Not never. A single time.
Italy promptly began fucking around in their occupation zone. The Italian government took the unofficial stance that, despite the actual wording of the treaty, they should be the only occupying power in the Adriatic. So they sent their army into the British and French occupation zones repeatedly. And at this time, the Italian army included the American 332nd Regiment, which was placed under the command of an Italian general during the war.
Are they gonna fuck around and find out, or are they just gonna fuck around?
A little bit of both. By sending the 332nd, Italy thought they could claim they were technically keeping more than one ally involved and abide by the armistice. But they also kicked out any European powers that might try to stop them from breaking the armistice. America was still seen, correctly at the time, as the weakest of the four powers, and the one least likely to intervene against Italy's irredentist ambitions, because that would mean they had to send more people to Europe, and, like, nobody wanted that in 1918. And,
you know, post-World War One America was still very much in their, like, what if we don't have to go to Europe? Yeah.
And they also... they also knew that Woodrow Wilson had big ambitions for the Paris Peace Accords and wouldn't want to disrupt that early on.
Oh, God, no. We might disrupt the Peace Accords and, you know, the formation of the League of Nations.
It's very important that this United States-led effort succeed.
The United States-led effort to create the League of Nations that we will not join.
No matter how hard he tries.
When he was informed about this, Wilson did want to withdraw the 332nd immediately, and only didn't because pissing off Italy would disrupt the peace conference and risk restarting the whole war. So, U.S. naval officials in the Adriatic were tasked with investigating and making a formal report on the situation. One official and one in secret. Both investigations reported that Italy was blatantly trying to seize control of the occupation zones in violation of the November 11th agreement. Woodrow Wilson didn't have an option after that but to take his troops out of the situation, so the 332nd were sent home, and the United States sent a letter scolding the Italian government.
Oh, there you.
Love sending strongly worded letters. A strongly worded letter is my favorite form of...
We trusted you.
Right up there with thoughts and prayers.
Sending my thoughts and prayers in a strongly worded letter to your enemies.
I'm sending you some thoughts
and
prayers. I'm sorry, but head empty. No thoughts.
The non-Italian allies, but especially the United States, were still committed to making Yugoslavia happen, and Wilson ordered the American occupation forces to assist local Yugoslav governments with whatever was deemed necessary. This was especially important in the American and French occupation zones, where there quite simply were not that many Eastern Italians to begin with. The British occupation zone in Fiume was more open to debate, with over 60% of the urban population actually being Italians. However, none of this stopped the 2,000 or so Italian citizens of Split from rioting in February of 1919 in a demonstration against an Allied conference being held in the city. American Marines and sailors were sent out to back up the Yugoslav police force. The Americans didn't do anything, but their presence with, you know, machine guns and tanks probably helped defuse the situation and prevented uprising in the city.
Well, it's one thing Americans can do well is have guns with them.
We're the best at it. Best in the fucking world.
Oh, yeah. America's police, even from this early. Or world police, even this early.
This may be the first example of us really trying to fill that role.
Yeah, I don't... Because before World War One, we very much... Aside from, like, territories that we directly were conquering, we weren't very much into, like, having our troops just stationed places for, like, ideas of enforcement. It wasn't until after, like, this point that we really started doing that more. Obviously, there's, like, an exception for a lot of places in Central America, but I think that's more covered under, like, the Monroe Doctrine than, like, world police doctrine.
Yeah, and none of that was ever enforcing some abstract political thing. That was always related to a specific economic pressure or related to a more direct conflict.
Yeah. Not just, like, general peacekeeping or whatever.
Even, you know, the most general vague occupation you get is really Haiti, and we basically just controlled that one outright for a few years, so I don't feel like it counts either. After the riot, the Allies instituted a novel system of police work for the city of Split. Patrol squads rotated through the city day and night, with two officers and three men from each of the four Allied occupiers, plus one Serbian army soldier and one local cop. This kept everyone involved, limited accusations of nationalist bias, and actually did seem to calm ethnic tensions in the occupation zone. It turns out that when you have a police force that's representative of the people living there, even when they do view them as enemy combatants, it works out better. Imagine if we could both have cops who were from the place and didn't want to murder everybody. Or just not have cops.
What's that like?
I don't know, ask Rojava, I guess?
Well, even then.
They're at least representative.
That's
the
true.
The autonomous territory fucking of North cops. And East Syria loves its fucking quotas.
Hey, look. I'm not going to come on this podcast and talk shit.
I am.
They're doing it better than everyone else.
Well, I'll talk shit, but not about Northeast Syria specifically.
No, best not. The wild thing about these riots in Split is that the American occupation forces estimated that there were only about 3,000 Italians at most in the entire occupation zone, which spanned just over 100 miles of the Dalmatian coast. There were maybe...
So that's not a lot of Italians.
No, there were maybe 1,000 who actually lived in the city of Split.
This would be a pretty
percentage,
small.
Yeah.
And yet, they were campaigning hard to have Dalmatia annexed into Italy. For comparison, New York City alone was home to around 180,000 Italian-born residents at the time.
So, if anything...
Oh, I want to see the we need to do an Italian occupation, a straight up Italian occupation of the five boroughs, please.
I mean, they did for a while. Yeah, isn't that what Godfather's about?
They're Sicilian, and that could also start a fight here.
Yeah, because at this point in history, are the Sicilians Italian? That depends on who you ask.
Still depends on who you ask today.
Yeah, right. No, they're Libyan, obviously.
No, the Russian, come on.
But you're telling me Gaddafi didn't arm anybody in Sicily?
I mean,
no, I mean, I would never say that because I don't think there's any, I don't think there's anyone on earth Gaddafi didn't arm. That man loved nothing more than being like finding any group on earth and being like, hey, want some guns? I mean, he gave guns to the Black Panthers, gave guns to the IRA.
You gotta do an episode on this guy at some point.
The Sicilians. I mean, Gaddafi on his own is a series.
I mean,
for
I'll
somebody,
have to deal with
I
it
think.
Eventually, because eventually I'll cover the Libyan civil war.
I will, to continue on my, my Nate Bethaken comparison, I agree with Nate that the best thing Gaddafi ever did was go to the UN and propose the division and dissolution of Switzerland as an entity. And that Switzerland needed to be dissolved and have its constituent parts given to the countries around it. So, like, German-speaking Switzerland needed to go to Germany. Like, southern Switzerland needed to go back to Italy. And then western Switzerland to go back to France and just dissolve Switzerland as an entity. He proposed that on the floor of the UN, largely because he got in trouble in Switzerland and the judges couldn't be bought off. And so he wanted to just dissolve it as a country. But you know what? Maybe not his worst idea.
Yeah, I agree with that.
What a guy.
This is all Switzerland.
What a person who existed on Earth for and ruled a country for decades.
It's interesting, I'll give him that.
What a weird monster.
Yeah.
It's a terrible human being. But goddamn, was he interesting.
Well,
anyway,
shifting gears entirely. Lots of cute stories came out of this occupation period. In his 1925 report for the U.S. Naval Institute on Split 1919, Lieutenant Commander Richard Stockton Field, who was one of the ranking U.S. officers in the city, made sure to point out that there were patrol officers who made a point to teach their international squads one another's military drills, and others who would let the enlisted men have downtime when the patrol had to be stationary.
Wow, officers letting enlisted men have downtime.
Look, this was before all that research we did after World War II in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Field points out several examples of American sailors helping the city's numerous post-war orphans and how the various occupation forces taught one another their country's favorite sports and put on shows.
Go soccer.
Yeah, Well, then you also probably had cricket.
Yeah, because it was an English occupation.
I would guess that you had
zone,
some, like, so hodgepodge game of, like, cricket and baseball equipment being set up would probably have been one of the things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you just put a bunch of dudes together. You're like, I'm going to find a ball, and I'm going to hit it with something that looks like a big, long stick, and we're going to make
honestly,
a game
yeah.
out of this.
Wait, Babe Ruth would have been playing around this time, wouldn't he?
Yeah, probably. Must have. Unfortunately, even with these, like, stories of cheer and not trying to murder one another, even LTC Dick Field has to acknowledge that Dalmatia, in general, was anything but calm.
Lieutenant Corporal Dick Field?
Lieutenant Commander in this case, but yeah.
Okay, Dick Field. Oh, God, that's...
Respect the rank, Roberto. Respect.
He's a lieutenant commander. What a joke.
So Serbian army garrisons kept trying to institute Yugoslav law codes in violation of the armistice. Italy kept sending troops into the American occupation zone in violation of the armistice. Italian warships parked themselves right off the coast of Split, technically not a violation so long as they didn't come ashore. Which must have sucked ass for those sailors.
Oh yeah, just being parked on your boat right off the coast and being explicitly not allowed to disembark for any reason.
They kept ships stationed there for years.
Oh no.
They weren't far from the Italian zone where they could, like, go up the coast and land, but somebody had to be in the harbor at all times.
That's horrible.
And it's the same ships just rotating back and forth.
Never on Earth has there been a good time to be a sailor as a profession. particularly in a country's name.
The weird angle that my brother's thumb sticks out at now can testify to that. At one point, the Italian occupation zone stopped an American aid ship from bringing food to American-occupied Dalmatia and just stole all the food. Good thing that never happens.
Man. Yeah, I was going to say, good thing that has never happened in any conflict since.
And the Italian troops in the international patrols routinely harassed the Croatian civilians. Not super surprising there. In April of that year, the patrols were disbanded in favor of Yugoslav military patrols taking on more responsibility with American backup. And the Italian troops, in particular, were kicked out of Split altogether.
Man, if only I could think of another occupation where the occupation was mostly done by American and their allies' troops, and then slowly mixed in with troops from the country they were occupying, and then they attempted to slowly hand over occupation duties, patrol duties, to the locals, which then fell apart immediately upon the U.S. withdrawing from those patrols.
I don't know which place you're referring to, because there's several of them.
Isn't it Vietnam?
You could call Vietnam. We could be talking about Iraq or Afghanistan. We could be talking about numerous
Korea
places.
At least twice. Yeah.
Korea two separate times.
On top of this, the Italian occupation was a complete shit show. Admiral Enrico Milo, or had just declared himself the Italian governor of their occupation zone in 1918, and was only confirmed by the Kingdom of Italy after the fact. By that point, he was already ruling the Italian governorate of Dalmatia as a dictator.
That took it.
God, I love just declaring yourself being in charge of things.
And then just be given permission after the fact. It's like, yeah, you can stay in charge. No worries at all.
God, the next couple of paragraphs are fucking insane.
This is what I expect from your show, Trevor.
All right, I'm ready. I'm locked in.
Yugoslav civilians were treated as second-class citizens. They could be beaten for any perceived infraction. Their ration cards were confiscated. Slavic civil servants were harassed into quitting their jobs. Local government councils were dissolved. Slavs were denied access to healthcare, and there were outbreaks of smallpox. All of it sent a flood of refugees into the American occupation zone. I did not do this on purpose. This was not supposed to be a timely episode when I picked it out.
Yeah. Where is that showing up these days? Who knows?
Fuck the Israeli government, man.
For real.
Israel Delinda asked.
Responding to the Allied protest against an Italian army detachment encroaching on the Yugoslav border, one moderate Italian legislator said, "The Yugoslavs do not exist. They have never existed. They are merely Croats, and we know by bitter experience that they are more or less savages controlled by the priests."
Why is this?
You know, believe it or not, I feel like that could have been said by an Italian moderate this week.
Yeah? Uh-huh. And also, why is this, like, so... It's 1927. It's 97 years out. Why is this so similar to what's going on today? What the actual fuck?
Now, in that legislature's defense, I might say that the idea of a united Yugoslavia didn't really work out.
It's true. And to be fair, like, the idea that, like, there is a Yugoslav as, like, an entity was, like, new. But just being like, yeah, but any of them are actually just Croats, and we know Croats are barbarians controlled by the priests. Which, look, it's pretty rich for the Italians to be complaining that another group of people are controlled by the Catholic Church. Like, yeah, that's pretty rich.
Kurods are Catholic, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah. No, no, you don't understand. They made the Vatican its own little dot.
Like, the Italians are accusing people of being papists? Like, what are you on about?
I didn't even catch that. Holy shit.
Literal papal capital is in your capital city.
You guys invented this. You invented it like you did fascism. Why are you putting this on somebody else?
You're like two paragraphs early.
I know. I know about Gabriel D'Annunzio.
I want to be absolutely clear here. Enrico Milo and the Kingdom of Italy, like certain other countries that start with a fucking I, were carrying out a policy of ethnic cleansing and genocide during the occupation of Dalmatia. Of course, nobody called it that at the time. The word genocide was coined after the Second World War, and they weren't just murdering all the Slavs. However, the official, internationally recognized definition of a genocide that you would be, I don't know, put on a Nuremberg trial for, includes both causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group, and deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction. And those fit both of the occupations we've referenced today to a fucking T.
Yes,
sure do.
Fortunately, the U.S. occupation zone in this case did a better job than any of Israel's neighbors have managed. Seeing the flood of refugees, Admiral Andrews wrote in a dispatch, "The more I see and hear, the more I know the Italian demands are without justice and their actions based only on cruelty and lack of consideration. They are totally unreasonable."
Just like another country that starts with an I.
And I just want to say, on like a lighthearted note, I fucking love the weird middle ground between like formal Victorian English and like the beginnings of modern colloquial English that you can get in here.
Yeah, where like you've got some words where you're like, what?
And then it ends with, "and they are totally unreasonable."
Yep.
Like, yeah, you're reading something that seems pretty formal and just ends with, "yeah, totally, bro." And you're like, ah.
You know, him being a sailor, you know his inner monologue, which is full of cursing.
Oh.
He's too high ranking of a sailor for that. Because what I think a lot of people that aren't familiar with the Navy don't realize is that the Navy is also the most class-based military organization, particularly the British and the American, where you have officers who get entirely separate stairwells on some boats so they don't even have to see the enlisted sailors, and have like messes that where they're served entirely by the enlisted, and then the enlisted men who are the ones you think of when you think of like rotten mouth, dirty, like louse-ridden sailors. The officers are like their own class of bourgeois on a Navy ship.
And this is why they were the last branch to desegregate.
Ooh.
Yes, they were the last branch to desegregate because the officers literally considered themselves a class above.
I was just going based off of what my uncle was telling me when I was growing up, and he was an NCO in the Navy, so.
Yeah, so he was enlisted, yeah.
The Treaty of Versailles was formally signed on the 28th of June, 1919, forcing Italy to recognize the new Kingdom of Yugoslavia and requiring the Allies to begin winding down the occupation. Arguments over specific border details shifted to further negotiations in the Italian town of Rapallo, initially focused on the border proposed by Woodrow Wilson, but the new Yugoslav government was desperate to just get any kind of settlement and stop having Italy invade them every couple of weeks. Italy wanted to take everything they could get their hands on. And that brings me to a man we keep mentioning, the popular figurehead of Italian irredentism, Gabriel D'Annunzio. Poet, sex symbol, womanizer, war hero, soon-to-be petty dictator and founding father of fascism.
Okay, I need to see how this guy is a sex symbol. Show me the picture.
Now...
Oh, here's the thing. You might not agree based on the picture, but people at the time definitely.
Is this something you're
going to
send, or should I just look it up really quick?
Oh, no, I'm about to send it to you.
Okay.
Now, this isn't an episode about D'Annunzio, and you may have guessed from that resume that he's kind of a complex figure.
Yeah, a womanizing petty dictator, poet, playwright, or war hero, founder of fascism. He's certainly a guy.
Unfortunately, Gabriel here is really important to the events that we are here to talk about. So I'm going to do the Spark Notes version, and to set the stage, I want you to have a look at some pictures of this guy.
Okay, let's do it.
All right, here is picture number one.
Oh, hot damn! Ooh!
Aurora, I want you to describe this one.
Ooh!
This is a dapper, I'd say fairly dapper looking man in a nice suit, a tie and a little boutonniere look, reading a book. He's got a balding, but the hair is cropped close, and I'd say a fairly nice fashion. Got a little pointy goatee, a silly little mustache turned up at the corners. Not my type, but I can see why he would have been popular with the women of 1920.
Oh, hot damn, he's hot.
All right.
Or with Roberto.
And Roberto, I want you to describe this one.
Okay.
I've seen this photo before, so.
So it is Gabrielli who is standing in like a macho man pose, arms that is, making an arc on his sides, on his waist. He's showing off his muscles. You can see his pecs and everything, and he's just wearing a banana cloth on his crotch, and that's it. That is all he's wearing.
Just full banana hammock.
Yeah, banana hammock.
Full banana hammock. I'll tell you what. He's pretty cut. He's pretty clean. He's pretty muscular. I'll give him that.
I can see why he was a sex symbol. Like, that guy can get it.
I couldn't find any good pictures of him wearing it, but I just also need you to know that he had a custom-made kimono-style robe with a jack-off hole in one of the pockets.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, I did know about that.
I knew nothing
too
about this man, so this is just like, oh, damn. I see why he's a sex symbol.
And I do want you all to keep in mind, this man helped invent fascism.
Well, you know what they say.
Oh, boy, did he. So, as we've established, the next paragraph in my script reads, Gabriel D'Annunzio is a bizarre figure and way too easy to get sidetracked with. So bear with me as I try to squeeze in the bare-bones summary while still hitting the highlights of this weird little freak.
He was trying to squeeze in something, all right.
I knew that I had to have Roberto back when I realized that picture was part of it.
Why me? Yeah.
Because you'd give me the best reaction.
I mean, you did just say he could get it, so...
True.
So, born into a wealthy Italian merchant family, D'Annunzio was genuinely extremely smart. Unfortunately, nobody around him ever let little Gabrielle forget this. He was constantly praised to near sanctification all through his childhood. As young as a teenager, three basic trends started to emerge in his character. D'Annunzio was an excellent poet, praised on more than one occasion as the greatest Italian writer since Dante. He was an Italian nationalist and irredentist who strongly believed in his own people's importance to the world. And he fucked.
Oh, yeah, he could. Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Don't get too excited. Working backwards, as as he grew older, D'Annunzio banged his way through the Italian and European upper crust from married noble women and merchants' daughters to at least one famous lesbian painter who just wanted to see what all the fuss was about. Given that this was the 1800s and that he wrote extensively about how much he liked going down, I'm guessing it was a combination of that and the banana hammock picture I showed you a minute ago.
He was muscular and was the first man to admit that going down on women ruled.
So, yeah, he's okay. I hate the fact that he's an interesting guy. I hate the fact that he's the founder of fucking fascism.
Which, if I can say, it is interesting because later on, especially into the modern day, you would never get fascists this openly, like, sexual.
No.
As he is. You know what I mean? Like, you would never get a modern, like, fascist to admit that, like, going down on a woman.
No, Hitler, it reminds me
of this type of fascism.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, Hitler basically killed. You know what? If we can stereotype, of course this man was Italian.
He was Italian or French. There were really only two options for this kind of person.
So
I am fascist and I love oral. All right, yeah, you're
so
either
this
French
reminds me of
Italian.
The one episode of The Sopranos where the uncle, I forget his name, basically has a whole episode where like Tony's making fun of Junior going down on his girlfriend, and it's just like, okay, but like this guy did it. He was a deputy of the Kingdom of Italy.
Yeah, and
well,
bizarrely, there's basically never even a hint of like impropriety of any sort from his sexcapades in the upper class.
It all seemed among the upper class. It all seemed willing.
Yeah, there's in all of the like those absurd 19th century journals that everybody was keeping. Nobody ever talks about him like being unwantedly flirtatious with someone in the upper class.
So if someone told him no, he said,
just wait.
Okay.
Less shockingly, he had a goddamn fetish for raping peasants.
Never mind!
He sure did.
He wrote extensively about that, too.
Okay.
Just in his diaries that he knew he was gonna publish.
Because he didn't think it was a crime.
No,
because
they weren't people.
So I was about to give him the benefit of the doubt that he had to go and fucking ruin it. I hate this guy.
Again, I could reference another group of people right now who often commit sex crimes because as an occupying force because they believe that the people they're doing it to aren't people. But
anyway, his poetry.
Yeah, let's move on.
Gabriel's poetry started winning acclaim from his teachers very early on, and even though those teachers were nuns, disgusted by how goddamn horny all of it was such high-quality use of the Italian language that they still had to praise it. Between some promotion from his wealthy father and a publicity stunt where Gabriel claimed that he had died just before one of his early books was published, he became one of the most famous poets of Europe at the time. And it's kind of hard for people today to understand when poetry is this erudite, refined thing. But poets at the turn of the 20th century were like rock
stars.
Yeah,
I can attest to that.
I think the easiest way to contextualize it is by remembering that mass audio media wasn't widespread yet. Like, they had wax cylinders and records around, but the quality was shit. And radios, cassettes, good records, etc. are still decades away. So the most popular way to consume words in verse was well-written poetry.
I mean, that's what you had, and you're right. Like, they were rock stars at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, it seems really weird today to be like Lord Byron and Gabriel D'Annunzio were sex symbols because they were really good at writing poems, but like, they filled that cultural niche for their time.
No, and I can attest, because like, on Patreon, we're covering a 19th century poet who was a sex symbol. Aurora, you gotta learn all about him.
Oh boy.
Yes.
As he got older, D'Annunzio got more and more nationalistic and more involved in politics. Despite the war's general unpopularity that kept Italy from siding with the Central Powers in the first place, D'Annunzio was one of the most prominent voices calling to join the Allies in 1914. He wrote pro-war propaganda and anti-German, anti-Hungarian, and anti-Slavic poems. Because if there's anything Gabriel D'Annunzio was better at than writing and fucking, it was racism.
Okay, this guy's just getting worse and worse.
Germans, barbarians. Hungarians, more barbarians. Slavs, mm-hmm. the most barbarians. The dude just hated all of Italy's neighbors and was so pro-war because he was an irredentist. He saw World War I as an opportunity to reclaim the territory they had lost hundreds of years earlier. He didn't fight on the front lines, but he was injured flying in a bombing raid, and during his time in the early Italian Air Force, which he helped to found, D'Annunzio became one of the first people to invent the tactic of dropping propaganda behind enemy lines in the form of leaflets, which he wrote thousands of by hand.
Oh, God. You can tell he's nobility, because, or like at least super fucking rich, because he had all the time to do that shit and just had the cushy job of, let me fly a freaking plane, of all things.
Flying an airplane in World War I was cushy.
But they were the knights of the sky. It was heroic.
It's true. Yeah. It was heroic, but you could also easily die.
I mean, you had the Red Baron.
Arguably the most dangerous per capita branch of the armies in World War I.
I mean, you're in a thing made of balsa wood with an engine strapped to it. It's likely you're just going to fall out of the sky.
After the war, D'Annunzio was enraged by the Allied occupation of the Adriatic because, to him, it was all rightfully Italy's. On September 12th, 1919, just after the armistice was settled and the occupations were winding down, he set out with an army of 2,500 Italian veterans to invade and occupy the city of Fiume, officially the center of the British occupation zone. Fiume is a weird case. Like I said, it had been outside of Italian governance for most of its history, but was close enough to Italy to have a slim Italian majority. D'Annunzio successfully ran the Allies off, which meant he went to war with Britain, which gets overlooked in discussions of this that I found when I was reading about it, and met with the local Italian colonel to try and give the city to Italy directly, since that would upend any hopes of negotiating more territorial concessions. The government refused.
Yeah, we're not going to let you just conquer a city and then give it to us.
Instead, Gabriel D'Annunzio declared himself Il Duce.
Oh, no!
And his new fiefdom, the Italian Regency of Carnaro.
No! He's the one who started this bullshit?
We said he invented it. He literally declares himself Il Duce.
Oh, my fucking God. This guy's just getting worse and worse and worse.
And specifically described his position as ruling as a dictator like Julius Caesar.
I can see where Benito Mussolini gets his whole aesthetic from.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I mean, literally, yes.
He outfitted his militia troops with black shirts as their uniforms.
What? What? Is this just like 20
this is the origin
less than 20 years
of the Italian black shirts.
This is like 10 years.
Yeah. Not even.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Where does Mussolini even fucking come in?
Benito did not invent this. He literally just took something that already existed and was like, I can use this.
And then everyone's like, I made this.
Yeah, and he wasn't the only one. D'Annunzio organized the workers and businesses of Fiume into 9 corporations, declared the regency to be a, quote, corporatist state, and gave those new corporations a direct role in his weird little government. For reference, other countries to call themselves corporatist states include Salazar's Portugal and fascist Spain.
Hey.
Oh my gosh.
Kitty.
But because there were like 2,500 dudes and this rich fuck boy in charge, they couldn't exert a lot of direct power in the streets of their new city-state. And Fiume became a haven of dissidents of all sorts. Communists, anarchists, extreme Italian nationalists, Yugoslav partisans. Cocaine flowed like wine, wine flowed like water, and all of these political extremists could beat the shit out of one another to their heart's content, so long as they didn't personally offend Il Duce.
Yeah, that was, when I was learning about this, that was the wildest part, because even though he was, like, inventing fascism one step at a time, there were a bunch of communists and anarchists hanging out there, because as long as they didn't mess with him personally, he would let them just get into street fights, and he wouldn't arrest them generally.
Yeah, and people were still working out the fine lines between all of these ideologies. Like, the idea of Marxist communism and, like, anarchism as a belief set was really only like 60 years old at this point. And yeah, like all of these different ideas that congeal into fascism by the end of the story, like those are still getting worked out too. And they don't know, like, do we want to be kind of communist? How are we going to do this? Like, so all of these people are sharing ideas back and forth in Fiume and beating the piss out of one another. While that seems like not an ideal situation, one man was inspired by the occupation of Fiume. Another Italian nationalist attempted to copy his tactics, named Count Giovanni Antonio Nino Fanfogna, or Nino to his friends. And we will come back to that after ads.
This episode has been brought to you by the Reggenza Italiana del Carnaro. Take a listen to one of our corporate allies.
Wait, wait, wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's C-O-N-T-U-B-E-R-N ALESbooks.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out.
All right, we are back, and we are going to talk about Count Nino Fanfogna, who was a descendant of the last Venetian mayor of Trogir, that little island off the Dalmatian coast, smack in the middle of the American occupation zone. Trogir was even outside the borders proposed by the original Treaty of London before Italy entered the war. But that wasn't going to stop Nino. He was 32 years old, without an ounce of the fame or political position that made Gabriel D'Annunzio successful, but He was a count and had all the arrogance that nobility can buy.
Well, that makes sense.
Nino had been hanging out with the Italian lieutenant in charge of Propatnica on the Italian and American occupation zone border. He hoped that if he could just arrange for ethnic Italians to take control of Trogir, the Italian military would swoop in and annex it, which is weird because they didn't do that the first time someone tried this shit.
The next time.
Next we'll show time them. Work. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, can't get fooled again.
So, on September 23rd, 1919, Nino and two of his sons handed out guns to 90 loyal militants, rushed past the Yugoslav border guards, and raced to Trogir, where the local Italian political organizers seized control of the city and issued a proclamation to the mostly Croat population. Citizens of Trogir, we have felt the beating of your heart in response to the sacred voice of Italy, and we have sent you volunteer troops. Count Nino de Fanfonia is named dictator. We owe him our blind obedience. Long live the king. Long live Italy. That's the king of Italy, by the way.
Yeah. We owe him our blind obedience. Fantastic. No notes.
Named dictator, we owe him blind obedience.
I mean, it's just, they're just following the ancient Roman tradition of just naming new people to be in charge.
The situation in Fiume was already causing a diplomatic tinderbox between Italy and Yugoslavia. So when news reached the American occupation headquarters and split the next morning, the American Naval Command had a meeting with their Italian counterparts in the city to ask, "What the hell is this?" To which the Italians said, "We don't know. Looks like some stupid motherfuckers trying to start a war."
We've been fucking around, but not this one.
They were like, "Well, we didn't even ask for that island. There's like 12 Italians there."
And 9 of them just showed up with guns.
To make it very clear that A, the Allied occupation was still in effect, and B, that the Italian government had not just declared war on Yugoslavia, the Italians and Americans agreed to a joint operation to sail down and evict Count Nino. The Italians finally did something worthwhile with one of the ships they had parked just outside of Split and sent the cruiser Puglia alongside the American destroyer USS Cowl and the USS Olympia, a protected cruiser that might have to get its own biography episode because it's one of those ships that will be a recurring character on the show. Also, literally no written source I found mentions these, but there are photos of submarine chasers from both Italy and the US arriving in Trogir on September 24th. I don't know why that's left out, but there's photo evidence of it. So somewhere between 3 to 5 ships crossed Castella Bay and found the island city in the grips of an all-out riot. The Yugoslav garrison affecting the American occupation in Trogir had been captured in Nino's initial march on the city and detained. But the overwhelmingly Croatian population was furious and attacked Nino's soldiers in the streets. As they arrived, the American and Italian naval officers started trying to negotiate with Nino, who initially refused to back down despite his own government's protests. At least one community leader from the local Italian population actually met with the officers on the Puglia and offered his help because the Italians who lived in the city didn't want Nino there either.
Fuck around and find out, you damn noble.
They were like, "No, we're good. Your family hasn't been here in like 100 years.
We don't care."
Didn't you hear, like, monarchy is on its way out? Look at the Austrians.
If the Habsburgs and their chins are gone...
Yeah, I mean, this guy's got to have some Habsburg in him too, right? Italian nobility?
Got to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, most Western European nobility will have Habsburg in them.
Yeah, just statistically.
Yeah.
Well, then they heard shots ring out from in the city as the Ninoists fired into the air from their trucks to drive off the crowd.
Yeah, it definitely just won't incite a further riot.
Well, to put an end to this, 100 Marines deployed from the USS Olympia and marched into Trogir. Faced with the much better trained and armed Marines of an actual state military, Count Nino's men surrendered, and the Count himself was forced to abandon any hope of retaining his conquest.
Lol, get wrecked.
Nino, his sons, and most of the other prominent Italians in Trogir were arrested and turned over to the Yugoslav government they had tried to overthrow, just so they could sort out who was actually involved in the putsch or not. it was literally like, you're going to be held in jail until we can interview you, and then we'll go from there. All they had really succeeded in doing here was sparking an anti-Italian race riot in the city as local Croats burned Italian businesses and harassed prominent Italian families, which eventually caused most of the Italians of Trogir to give up and move to the Italian peninsula.
Good
job.
Count Nino, in an effort to make Trogir a part of Italy, successfully got all the Italians to leave.
Yep. In fact, he and D'Annunzio had basically screwed the entire Irredentist project in the Adriatic. While there was actually some argument to be made for Fiume with its slim majority population, Italians were such an extreme minority in the American occupation zone that it was hard to see Nino's putsch in Trogir as anything other than the exact sort of blatant imperialism that had started the Great War in the first place. It was such a mess that Enrico Milo, the genocidal military governor of the Italian occupation, actually thanked the Americans for apprehending Count Nino and sentenced him to prison in front of a military court.
Fantastic.
Love this.
Yeah, just really didn't do a good job for his own side there.
How did you fuck up that much?
Yeah, he had noble brain, where he was like, well, my family were the mayors here, so I have a hereditary right to own this town.
Of course, of course.
And I think he just tried to dress that up in politics. Anyway, despite general successes in Dalmatia and the very clear need for a mediator between Yugoslavia and Italy, the American occupation was forcibly wound down by Congress. After World War I, isolationism took off in the U.S. like wildfire, and despite all of Woodrow Wilson's hopes that the war would make the U.S. a major player in international affairs, that stance was now very unpopular. They would need another world war for that.
Yeah, we have to wait till the post-World War II consensus for that to be a thing.
Post-fascism clarity.
Well, and to agree, I kind of get it as also, like, it didn't work. We tried to be isolationist, and then Japan bombed Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was always extremely silly. The U.S. never had an Ice Cube's chance in hell of being isolationist. We were imperialist from the moment we came into existence.
It's literally built into our DNA.
We came from the British,
like, the whole structure of the country.
Doing just like Father taught us. Thank you, England.
Instead, Congress declared the U.S. occupation of Dalmatia useless as soon as the confiscated Austro-Hungarian warships were distributed among the Allies, and the legislature wanted to get American sailors home as soon as possible. That left the UK and France to deal with ongoing Yugoslav-Italian negotiations in Rapallo while US forces started packing up. The occupation didn't end quietly. January of 1920 saw another race riot in Split, with local Slavs attacking the city's Italians, ransacking every Italian-owned business in town, because again, there weren't very many of them. A few days later, Italian sailors from the ship Puglia came ashore with their rifles and machine guns to defend the Italians. And the occupation force didn't intervene directly here beyond ordering the Italians to get back on their ship. But Admiral Andrews, the last U.S. military governor in Dalmatia, got his shot in by denying the Italian government's attempt to seize more than their fair share of the Austro-Hungarian navy. He just sank the rest instead.
I will sink these instead of giving them to the Italians.
I mean, I don't blame them for that.
We got mixed up and thought those were the practice ships.
Oh, we screwed up.
Oh no.
We're so sorry. Bye.
Things calmed down briefly, but the sailors of the Puglia continued making threats, and in July 1920, a couple of petty officers on shore tore down a Yugoslav flag near Split's harbor. They were immediately attacked by the local Croat residents, sparking another race riot in the city, and the American occupation forces equipped the Yugoslav police to intervene and send everyone back to their homes. So not direct American troops, but American guns.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. Admiral Milo on the Italian side, you know, the genocide guy, responded to this affront against Italy by deporting hundreds more Slavs from the Italian occupation zone, flooding the Americans with another surge of refugees. He also offered reinforcements to the Americans to help keep the peace, which Admiral Andrews politely refused.
I don't need your extra soldiers, bud. Thanks.
You wouldn't need to offer if you hadn't deported a bunch of people from their homes.
Honestly, yeah. I think, you know, kicking people out of where they live is a war crime.
Yeah, it is, weirdly enough. The Geneva Convention already existed at this point, at least a version of it. Italy and Yugoslavia formally concluded the Treaty of Rapallo in November, and it didn't go nearly as well for the Italians as they had initially hoped. They were required to withdraw from their own occupation zone, with the exception of a few Italian-majority islands. The American, Italian, and French occupation zones all went to Yugoslavia. Italy got the Venezia Giulia, including friend of the pod Trieste, up north, and as a compromise after kicking Gabriel D'Annunzio out of the city, Fiume was made into an independent city-state and buffer zone.
So he fucked around and
does get kicked out eventually, but then they do leave Fiume as an independent city-state sort of buffer space between the two countries because they couldn't decide who to give it to.
Yeah.
The U.S. refused to withdraw before Italy, fearing that the Italians would simply invade and start a war with Yugoslavia right away. Even after the Olympia and most of the officer corps left Split in January of 1921, a single ship, the USS Reuben James, remained in Dalmatia until the end of September that year. They left two spare propellers, an American tugboat, and several tons of fuel behind as a sort of gift to the Yugoslavs. And there were initially fears that Italy would invade anyway. But aside from some trade disputes, that border remained surprisingly peaceful for the next 20 years.
What happens 20 years from now?
In 1941, in southeastern Europe? Oh, hard to tell. You'll have to go back and listen to episode 3.
Yeah, I have no clue.
The exception to this general peace was Fiume. Feeling betrayed by the treaty, Gabriel D'Annunzio actually declared war on Italy to force annexation.
Yes, he literally said, declared war on Italy to force Italy to annex his city. Yes.
What the fuck? What the actual fuck kind of thinking is that?
The thinking of a guy in a city where cocaine flowed like wine and wine flowed like water. Oh, and who absolutely had syphilis.
Oh, yeah. Definitely had a syphilitic brain at this point.
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, wearing a banana hammock is a result of syphilis, you know?
Clearly. It didn't work, at least not immediately. On Christmas Day 1920, an Italian army forced D'Annunzio to evacuate and arrested the rest of the black shirts. There was a very brief occupation, but the Kingdom of Italy successfully transitioned the region into the free city of Fiume in early 1921. D'Annunzio went back to Italy, jaded, less popular, but still influential and prominent. He considered himself and the experiment in Fiume to be part of the historical leftist movement.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
After all, he had formed the workers into corporations and given them a stake in the government. He had even let the CEOs and the managers join those unions.
That's how that works.
Oh no.
He had spent his life advocating for sexual liberation and individual rights. Parentheses, if you had money. Gabriel was downright progressive in his own mind.
In his own mind, that's where the, that's what's weighing the whole sentence.
And maybe that's what why he attracted the attention of a former member of the Italian Communist Party who had defected from the political left in favor of a pro-war stance back in 1914.
Can I guess who it is?
Yes, you can.
Is it Benito Mussolini?
It is Benito Mussolini.
It's Il Duce 2.
Number 2.
Mussolini, as we've said a couple of times now, modeled a lot of his public persona and ideology on Denuncian irredentism. He even outfitted his followers in black shirts, just like Denuncio, and advocated for a corporatist structure to the state. The trick with corporatism is that if it doesn't remove the boss, it just centralizes power around a few businesses. And irredentism was inherently a hyper-nationalistic, politically conservative ideology. Mussolini synthesized all of this into a new movement that he called fascism. And then he seized power in a putsch called the March on Rome in 1922, just 1 year after all of these occupation forces left.
Yeah, I didn't...
Oh, so he crossed the Rubicon.
No, he didn't even have to. He was already in Italy.
Oh, fuck.
And actually, I know. Crossed the Tiber, I guess. Like, literally, the March on Rome was just him collecting all the black shirts he had spread throughout Italy and being like, hey, you should all, like, just converge on Rome now.
Well, and he sent them ahead and came by train when it was all said and done.
Yeah, because he didn't want to be there for it to happen.
Denuncio became something of an unwilling mouthpiece and political celebrity in fascist Italy for the last decade and a half of his life. And in 1924, Mussolini entered into negotiations with Yugoslavia to formally annex the troublesome city of Fiume. Afraid of provoking a larger war with the militant nationalist Duce of Italy, the Kingdom of Yugoslavia allowed annexation. Though they all cited Mussolini more directly than Denuncio, a number of leaders seized power all across Europe with fascist corporatism. Spain's Francisco Franco, Portugal's Antonio de Oliveira Salazar, and of course, literally Hitler.
The literal Hitler.
And when Hitler sent Europe rolling toward another great war in 1941, Mussolini promptly returned to his roots and invaded Yugoslavia to seize control of the Adriatic, conquer further inland, and carry out ethnic cleansings of his own. Even by then, though, the U.S. occupation of Dalmatia had mostly faded from popular memory. But that didn't stop the Allies from beating the shit out of Mussolini and making Italy give the territory back, even after Yugoslavia went communist.
Yeah, even though Yugoslavia was communist, the Allies were like, Italy, you gotta give that back to the communists.
You fucked around, Italy, and you found out. You went with Denuncio and Mussolini. Fuck you guys.
About Italy finding out, you can... I think it was... like Lions Led by Donkeys did a series about the Italian invasion of Greece in World War II. How absolutely terrible the Italians were at waging war, getting defeated by screaming shirtless Greeks, strangling people to death with their bare hands.
Look, that tactic has worked for 2,500 years. Why would it stop working now?
Like the Greek soldiers and resistance were literally just beating the Italian soldiers to death barehanded.
Yeah, that is the U.S. occupation of Dalmatia. Do either of you have final thoughts?
Oh, I just love...
What the actual fuck?
Like, I know it's ostensibly about the American occupation, but like as we've talked about, like, the really important part here is like the waves and echoes like around it. And the fact that, like, mm-hmm. in this time and in this area was D'Annunzio and, like, the foundations of not just Italian fascism, but fascism in general and all the consequences that are downstream of that. And, like, the fact that American occupation, to some extent, stalled this sort of insane Italian irredentism that would come to the fore later. And, like, literally, as you pointed out, a year after we left, they just, like, got back to it.
And literally took over Italy and made it a fascist state. So, like, yeah. it just shows, like, how fast fascism can take over a nation.
So I'm saying is the American occupation of Dalmatia should have lasted longer, and we should have occupied Fiume.
Yeah, we really should have traded with the British on this one, because Wilson would not have fucked around with letting some random Italian poet come in and take over the American occupation.
No, Wilson would not have let a fuckboy poet conquer one of his cities.
Like,
with syphilis, yeah.
Say what you want, because there's a lot to be said about Woodrow Wilson, but I do not think he would have been a fascist.
No,
not at all. He's just a major racist, for sure, which he was. But, like, not a fascist.
No, Woodrow Wilson was the type of man to go, like, you know, I like what that Hitler fella is saying about the Jews, but I just can't get behind this imperialism.
Keep it in your own borders.
You know, take that out of context for Trevor, guys.
Don't you... If any of you fucking dare the history of Persia ends...
I'm joking, of course, but yeah.
From my own podcast, I may have a little soundbite I saved from one point of my co-host Ketho saying the Irish aren't white, completely out of context. But I did clip it when I was editing it. I just have that for posterity. Sorry, Ketho.
The whole thing is just. Not what I was expecting when I saw Landed in Croatia 1918.
Yeah, I was like, okay, back to, like, Yugoslavia, cool. And then I was not expecting the rise of fascism to sprout up from this. Not expecting fuckboy guy who can get it, but now really don't want him to because you may get syphilis from it. And get fascist stuff on you. He's a creep. He's a scumbag. I don't like him.
I will be honest, it's one of those weird situations where, like, obviously generally from this podcast, like, the U.S. doing stuff is bad, right? Like, that's the general vibe. But in this specific scenario, yeah. You're like, it actually wasn't. We were actually encouraging, like, weirdly peaceful relations between the various groups and stopping a worse imperial power from doing worse crimes in the areas where we could. And so, again, it's one of those very rare situations where you're like, I kind of got to give it to America for this one.
But remember, this is pre-World War I America, too, so...
Yeah, so we just were still actively doing genocide.
Yeah, like, we were still actively doing genocide throughout, like, the mainland U.S. But then we just sent our soldiers to Croatia to be like, hey, now, you Italians... We didn't consider you white until like 5 years ago. So you need to calm down.
And on one hand, like, this is a great example of how intervention can be a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not mm-hmm. in the sense of like it continues propping up nation states. I know people, you don't have to point that out, but like in the moment that can be the better option. If there's not a particular financial stake in it for the United States. Like, there's no reason we needed to prop up Yugoslavia. It's not like we were getting better trade deals out of doing that. We were already allies with Italy. Yeah. It was fine. Like, it's a weird example of doing something out of the goodness of Woodrow Wilson's charcoal heart.
Man, it is wild that off the top of my head now, I could think the two situations I can think of where intervention was good, and they're both in the Balkans.
Yeah. And yeah. Both of them scared us off of, like, doing anything good for another 20 years.
Yeah, and, like, the fact that it worked stopped us from, doing anything good the next time a bad thing happened.
We could use some interventionism and just stop sending money.
If you guys don't know what I'm talking about, the U.S. intervention in the Bosnian genocide, a good thing to do.
We'll get to that.
A good thing to do, but it went well and America got scared, and so then the Rwandan genocide happened and we didn't help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One American guy tried.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right, on that note, you guys want to share your podcasts? There's like six of them between the three of us.
Yeah, we... Well, I think it's technically five. Yeah, maybe it is six. Who knows? For me, again, I'm Aurora. My main show is Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism. It's a podcast about politics and themes heading in our genre fiction. Talk about fantasy and sci-fi books and what the politics of their authors come through in the stories. And then I'm the co-host of Czar Power, which I'll let Roberto explain.
And I'm Roberto from Czar Power. We're ranking the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin. We are currently still on hiatus, so when this comes out, Aurora is not officially on the show as of yet, but it'll be fun. It'll be great. I've got some stuff planned, and she's going to be editing all the time, so it makes me write a lot faster when I don't have to edit. And then History of Sacramento, Georgia, where we're going through Georgian history in the Caucasus, not the U.S. state. So I'll be seeing a bunch of Persia alongside Trevor. And then finally, Quest for Power, where I'm the co-host in ranking all the monarchs of Europe in a crazy attempt to go through European history. I don't know how we're doing it, but we're doing it.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. I don't have to research it, so it's fine.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming on. If anybody out there wants to hear more of my voice for some reason, you can find me on the History of Persia podcast, which covers ancient Iranian empires from 700 BC to 700 CE. And you can find me online at History of Persia or at History of Persia Podcast, because I'm not running a separate account just for this show. And if you want to support this show, leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, especially for a newer show like this. That's always really helpful. Until next time, don't start a podcast. It's not good for you.
It's like crack, guys. Just like Fiume, it's full of wine and cocaine.
Only sometimes.
Wait, wait, wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernalesbooks.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.